actually changing the order of the bills that are going to be heard, partially because some of the folks who are testifying on one of the bills needs to leave. And I'm also going to mention that because we have three bills up today, a lot of people who'd like to speak on them after the initial panels are going to have testimony at 3 minutes. And so if you have written testimony, our committee assistant, Natalie, you can hand that to her. And certainly if it's written, if you can summarize your testimony. So I guess I should open up the committee on Senate Environment and Natural Resources. And the first bill we're going to be hearing, we actually just have a few people want to testify on that, is Senate Bill 631. Is that correct?
So
I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 631, and then we'll go to 325 and then to 629. And Beth, if you can give us a summary, please.
Senate Bill 631 removes exemption for cleaning agents used in automatic dishwashers to be sold, offered for sale, distributed in Oregon if they contain 8.7% or less of phosphorus by weight.
Okay. So, colleagues, since you see that my name is on this bill, along with a couple of other members, I will give you a brief introduction, and then we're going to hear from a couple of folks. And again, I'm going to ask folks if they can keep their comments brief, otherwise we will cut you off. But I will briefly tell you about this bill. Senate Bill 631, it came to my attention because I am the chair of a national organization that deals with environmental issues, there were several states that were doing some legislation that I thought would benefit the state of Oregon. In 1991, and I was not here, I'm trying to think if any of the members were here, the legislature passed a bill that banned selling detergents that contain more than 0.5% of phosphorus by weight. And the concern was the input of phosphorus in water bodies can cause algal blooms and the growth of algae. But there was an exemption for dishwasher detergents, and you will hear a little bit about that, and they contain 8.7% phosphorus. So my background, I work in water quality issues, I'm a water resources planner, and the watershed that I used to work in was the Tualatin Basin that had a lot of phosphorus problems, so I learned a lot about phosphorus. Some of it was naturally occurring, some of it was coming from our wastewater. So what this bill does is it simply removes the exemption and clarifies that dishwasher detergents can only contain 0.5% phosphorus like all the other detergents in the state. You will hear just a couple of minutes, we have an amendment that was presented two amendments. We were able to wrap it into one,
mm-hmm.
I'm hoping. We have an amendment from the Department of Environmental Quality, and they're going to come up and talk about it, that changes the effective date to make it consistent with Washington's law, because there's about 10 states that have already adopted it. And I also met with the Soap and Detergent Association yesterday, who also has an amendment, and you're gonna hear from them, and they are requesting an exemption for commercial and institutional dishwasher detergents, so it's consistent with Washington's bill. So I'm going to now ask folks to come up and talk about this. First, we're going to have the DQ that's going to come up, and then actually I'll have Dennis, Christine from the DQ, and then Dennis from the Soap and Detergent Association is going to come up and talk about their amendments. And also Jennifer Weichel, I guess, is coming up. So why don't all three of you come up? And thank you for that indulgence, committee members. Christine, why don't you go first, and maybe you can provide just a little more background on the phosphorus ban.
Sure. Chair Dean Felder, members of the committee, my name is Christine Svetkovich from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Jennifer Weigel. We are here today to provide testimony on Senate Bill 631. Jennifer first is going to talk a little bit about phosphorus and the environment in general, and then I will walk through DEQ's proposed amendments to Senate Bill 631.
Thank you.
Chair Dean Felder and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Weigel, and I am the Standards and Assessments Manager at DEQ. As Christine mentioned, I'm here to provide some context with regard to phosphorus in Oregon's waters. Reducing the amount of phosphorus that ends up in rivers and lakes would be good for Oregon waters. DEQ expects that Senate Bill 631 would help reduce the amount of phosphorus getting into Oregon waters. Currently, Oregon does have lakes and river reaches that are impaired due to excess nutrients. When phosphorus gets into rivers and especially lakes, it acts as a fertilizer for algal and aquatic weed growth. An excess of algal growth can in turn cause lowered levels of dissolved oxygen and pH conditions in the water that are harmful to fish and other aquatic organisms. In some cases, excess phosphorus can lead to blooms of algae, including blue-green algae, which are unsightly and in some cases produce toxins that cause water quality problems. Excessive aquatic weed growth can impact swimming, boating activity, and other types of recreational activities. Reducing the amount of phosphorus entering sewage treatment plants would reduce the amount of treatment that municipalities would need to do to remove phosphorus. And this could result in significant cost savings to municipalities or treatment districts and their respective ratepayers.
I have passed out a hand and gross version of Senate Bill 631. In Section 1, DEQ is proposing to change the shall to may regarding the Environmental Quality Commission adopting rules governing labeling requirements about phosphorus and cleaning agents. This is due to the fact when the original phosphorus bill regarding cleaning agents was passed in 1991, DEQ did not go through rulemaking. That is because the bill, as is pretty much self-implementing. At the time, DEQ sent letters to retailers, sellers, and distributors of dishwashing detergents regarding the new requirements. DEQ expects the same process if Senate Bill 631 passes, thus rulemaking is not needed. In addition, in Section 3, DEQ proposes to change the effective date to July 1, 2010. This would allow DEQ enough time to get the word out about the new requirements and also would allow those that sell automatic dishwasher detergents to come into compliance with the new requirements. Thank you for your time. Are there any questions for us?
Do you have any questions for the agency? Okay, seeing none, we're going to hear from Mr. Griesing, and thank you for coming here today and boosting our economy because we understand you flew in from Washington, D.C.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Griesing, Vice President of Government Affairs, Soap and Detergent Association. I'm going to commit it on Natural Act for a trade association. I'm going to support a ban. You won't see this often.
You are on record, you know that.
But you too tonight.
In 2006, we reached an agreement with the state of Washington, which has a statewide ban going into effect July 1st, 2010. They asked the industry when could it produce a consumer acceptable product. At that time, we told them July 1st, 2010. In the interim period, we have been actively promoting this legislation. It would affect only household products such as Cascade and Finish. It would take them down to a maximum level of 0.5%, which is the traditional trace element level that's been allowed in virtually every statute that's been passed. Regulating phosphorus and cleaning products, and that goes back to the 70s. Currently, 12 states have passed the law. And there are only in California did the governor veto it for reasons we still don't understand. And then it is pending in four other states this year. New Hampshire, where we've come to agreement on the amendments. Montana, same. Connecticut, and of course, based on what I've heard today, here in Oregon. We are requesting a continued exemption for commercial products. The reasons are very important. One, commercial products have to do with the public health, getting the plates clean in large institutions. Commercial institutional dishwashing is another animal. It is not like what you have at home. Cycles are extraordinarily short, up to a minute. The products use much higher water and higher alkalinity. Again, this is to assure a clean plate at the end of the day and minimizing any potential for foodborne illness. Those conditions, however, have the consequence of rendering one of the principal ingredients that we now use in household products inactive, and that's enzymes, which are used to remove starches and fats. The high water and the temperature and the alkalinity kills the enzymes. So this is a formulatory dilemma that the industry is looking at but has not been able to overcome. And so I'll be happy to answer any questions. We seem to be in agreement on the date and the commercial exemption.
Great. Well, I certainly appreciate your industry coming forward and supporting this. It doesn't always happen that way. So we appreciate your willingness to work with us. And as I said, we're getting the amendments drafted right now, so we won't be moving forward today with the bill because we're waiting for the amendments.
Well, I want to express my appreciation for your working with us on and your understanding of this situation.
Well, and for your taking the industry actually taking leadership and coming forward. We understand you're still working on the commercial product end, and I think, colleagues, you have the list in front of you of all the states where it's already been implemented. So appreciate that. Any questions for the industry representative? One last question I had is, what percentage of detergent that is sold is commercial versus residential? Do you have a?
I don't know.
Okay. Maybe that you can follow up with an email.
I can attempt to determine that. However, I must tell you that I don't know any of my members' market share. We work under extraordinarily tight antitrust restrictions because of the competitiveness of the industry. I can put it in perspective for you in terms of the impact, the contribution of phosphorus to the environment, which I think you might find instructive. The last major work to determine the contribution of phosphorus by cleaning products to the environment was undertaken in Minnesota. It was the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency undertook a study in 2003 that was delivered in 2004. And the contribution of commercial dishwashing detergent phosphorus to the surface waters of the state of Minnesota, which is 0.9% by their calculations. So it's de minimis.
Okay. That's helpful. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you,
agency folks. And we're going to hear last from Sue Marshall with the Tualatin Riverkeepers and Andrea Salinas, Oregon Environmental Council. And again, since we have two other bills, we'll ask you to keep your comments brief, and if you can summarize your handouts, it'll be helpful.
I assume all of these are in support of it. Like you just say ditto.
Yeah. We're actually going to give you 3 minutes, but you don't need to use all those 3 minutes.
All right. I'll be quick. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Tualatin Riverkeepers in support of Senate Bill 631, and I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, very much for bringing this forward. The Tualatin Riverkeepers is a community-based organization with over 800 members. We work to protect and restore the Tualatin River system. Just to provide a little historical perspective, I am the former executive director of Tualatin Riverkeepers, and the Tualatin River was the first water body in the nation for which Clean Water Act total maximum daily loads were set, and there was a limit set on phosphorus. And at that time, because the Tualatin River, well, and it still is, a very slow-moving river, very sensitive to excess nutrients, the limit was set incredibly low at 0.07 milligrams per liter. The challenge was met in part by a ban on phosphorus, first implemented through the metro region and then statewide. I've included in my testimony a copy of an evaluation that was conducted 7 months after the regional ban on phosphorus, and just to highlight a few of the results. There are two major treatment plants that discharge to the Tualatin River. The Durham treatment plant experienced a 22.2% per capita reduction in phosphate. Rock Creek treatment plant experienced a 40.1% per capita reduction in phosphate. This was really more dramatic reduction than they expected, but it was in part due to one of the major industrial dischargers who, rather than put their phosphoric acid down the drain, shipped it down to Albany to be converted to fertilizer. And the estimate on cost savings for the treatment plants was $21,400 per month. So in our mind, expanding the limit on phosphorus to dishwashing soap is really pretty much a no-brainer. It saves utilities. It improves water quality. There are 54 stream reaches and water bodies throughout the state that are limited in their water quality due to phosphorus. I've attached that list. And then just an added note related to sustainability. Phosphorus is an important element. It's used in agriculture, commercial and industrial uses, largely mined from phosphate rock. It's estimated that 50% of the global reserves of phosphate rock are found in Arab nations, and much like oil, there are estimates of peak phosphorus. So it should be used wisely, and we very much urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Andrew?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports SB 631. According to DEQ's most recent list of streams that violate water quality standards, the 303D list, at least 40 streams and three lakes, as Sue said, in Oregon currently violate water quality standards for phosphorus. DEQ has developed total maximum daily load, or TMDL, plans to improve reduction of phosphorus loads in those water bodies. High levels of phosphorus can be found in streams along the coast, in the Portland metro area, in eastern Oregon, in the Willamette Basin, and in southern Oregon. This bill will help communities achieve TMDLs and keep our rivers clean. Phosphorus pollution often causes algae blooms, as Chair Dingfelder mentioned in her introduction, which create an unsightly, smelly mess and robs the water of the dissolved oxygen fish need to breathe. As currently written, the current ban on phosphorus, the levels from cleaning agents such as laundry detergent, but it exempts automatic dishwashing detergents. That made sense at the time that the bill was drafted, but now we should lift that exemption. Phosphate-free dishwashing detergents are now widely available, and not only in specialty stores such as New Seasons, Whole Foods, and Trader Joe's, but even more mainstream stores such as Fred Meyer and Target. These low-phosphate products get the job done. Consumer Reports give them its top rating of excellent. In recent years, laws requiring automatic dishwashing detergent to contain no more than 0.5% of phosphorus have passed in several states, including Washington, Maryland, Vermont, Minnesota, and Illinois. SB 631 would bring Oregon in line with these other states. In response to the passage of these bills around the country, the industry is working to develop and market more phosphate-free dishwashing detergents. Again, the Oregon Environmental Council asks you to support SB 631.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions for either of the panelists? Okay. Thank you, ladies. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill, Senate Bill 631? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 631, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 325. Beth, you can provide us an overview.
Senate Bill 325 expands the list of allowable uses of an area zoned for exclusive farm uses to include a tract of land with structures that are regularly used for weddings and other commercial gatherings, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. Also, just for the committee's knowledge, we have received a good chunk of email on this bill, and we do have a packet available. We can recreate it for you if you would like to see it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Beth. And I would like to invite up Senator Metzger, who is the chief sponsor of this bill.
I could bring my constituent up.
Certainly. And I will mention for folks, we have a lot of people that like to testify on this, so after the senator introduces the bill, we are going to actually hear from the agency, and then we'll have testimony, and I will be doing 3 minutes, so again, I'll ask folks to be concise. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and thank you for hearing this bill today. Senate Bill 325 is derived from my constituent's effort to protect her historic home that resides on land zoned as exclusive farm use. Mrs. Wilson is here with me. She'll detail her story, but I want to give you some background on the bill first. SB 325 permits certain properties within exclusive farm use zones to be utilized for weddings and other commercial gatherings. The original drafting of the bill, and we all know this goes, colleagues, was broader than what we had requested. As written, this bill would allow commercial gatherings to take place on farmland. Current law does allow EFU land to host some events, but limits events to only a few occurrences a year. Though this original draft has appealed to many and may disappoint some to tell them this, it's too broad in our opinion by including any farmland owner who now wishes to use their farmland for commercial events. The Dash 1 Amendment, which I believe you have, gets us to what we had originally requested, which is to allow historic properties on EFU land to host events. We believe there needs to be a careful balance between protecting historic properties in the state and in preserving farmland. The Dash 1 Amendment limits commercial gatherings to farmland properties that also have historic buildings on the land. In the Dash 1, historic properties are defined by being on the National Historic Properties Registry. They have a rigorous registration process and stringent standards on maintaining the property. Using the definition will limit the number of properties who will qualify under this new statute. And in fact, Madam Chair, the State Historic Preservation Office was really unable to tell us how many may qualify. There's only a few hundred actually real home properties. There's a lot of libraries and schools on the historic list. There's only a few hundred actually homes, and most of those are in urban settings and not on EFU. Our best guess is probably under a dozen properties that even qualify under this Dash 1 amendment. I realize that the any land use bill comes with opposition. Some people want to do everything on farmland. Some people want to get a permit to sneeze on farmland, so I understand that. I believe, though, it's in the state's best interest to protect historic properties, just as we desire to protect farmland. And giving historic property owners another avenue in which to utilize their property, even if it's on farmland, may help other people participate in the historic property program and give those currently enrolled in the program an opportunity to preserve and a reason to preserve that property. And as Mrs. Wilson will talk in a moment, and I think she'll explain when you talk about EFU, her lot is not 80 acres. It's only 6 acres. Across the street is a fire station. Next, also across the street, is a grange. There is a business rodeo on the other side of her, and then a Clackamas County gravel pit up from there. That's that, and she has 6 acres with the home on it that's not obviously able to be farmed. Thank you, Madam Chair, and with your indulgence, I'd like my constituent to talk about her situation.
Certainly. Welcome, and if you can state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Shirley Wilson. And Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, thank you for letting me share my story today. My husband and I have lived in Clackamas County for 25 years, and we've raised our family on a small piece of land under the EFU ruling. And Senator Mesker mentioned it's only 6 acres, even though 80 acres is the zoning that we are under. It's much too small to be profitable. But this historic home does, this historic farm does involve a beautiful two-story Victorian home, several outbuildings, an orchard, and a huge barn. The State Historic Preservation Office visited and said we were very accurate in our restoration. The Hallmark Movie Channel stopped by and asked if we were interested in becoming a movie set. HGTV came to us and said, may we do a story on your place? So we really feel we have a unique farm complex that showcases the Oregon, early Oregon history. We have photos of the family that built and lived in the place. We have a scrapbook, some of the original pieces of furniture. It truly is a little time capsule. With the state historic overlay, we understood special uses would open up to us. We understood we could become a bed and breakfast, an antique shop, a tea house, do wedding events. All kinds of things were open to us if we allowed it go from the county to the state level. And so we cooperated, and we even took it a step farther, putting it onto the National Register. We were very excited about sharing our property with the public because it is just so unique. Our Upper Logan community was a little community that had a one-room school, a post office, a general store, blacksmith shop. I mean, it was a regular community, but all of that is gone now. It is just our home that's left, but it's not quiet farmland. Senator Metzger explained about the barrel racing next door and how that big field becomes a campground during the summer for hundreds of pickups. There's an arena with football stadium lights, a viewing box, a loudspeaker system. The fish farm across the street has busloads of kids coming to go fishing and families. Local grange has year-round events. The county dump trucks with the gravel pit nearby are coming to a stop right at the corner of our property because of the stop sign there. I now know what Jake brakes sound like. The fire station has bells and whistles. It's not a lot of farm activity. It's not 80-acre zoning. They're not true farms. So with the idea that there were land use variances, I applied for a special use permit about 12 years ago. We were hoping to do a bed and breakfast. I got a conditional land use permit approved, house occupation permit approved, fire marshal inspection, a building permit, which I didn't ever understand why we weren't building anything, soils permit. And I kept saying, am I done now? Because I thought I just needed the one permit. During this time, I also agreed we would limit it to 2 bedrooms. I would not advertise. We'd use an agency. I would have no sign on the property. I would limit cars in the driveway. I would keep the noise down. I finally made an appointment with a commissioner saying, what's going on? How long does this take? When am I finished? What's the end of this? And when done, I realized this isn't going to work. So after about 2 years, I gave up, went back to teaching, and we just enjoyed where we were living. Well, it's been 25 years now. The restoration's pretty complete. We've raised our family. We're ready to downsize, enjoy our 5 grandchildren, and move on. We listed the market when the market was good. But we were worried that the next owner might not appreciate the historic beauty of this place. And we found we attracted 3 different types of buyers. The first were small families that wanted to have a farmhouse with a little acreage for horses, 4-H projects and all of that. But they'd look at the historic and say, well, this isn't going to work. We need to update the buildings. We need to change this. They didn't want the regulations. Another group were the historical people. They enjoyed the history of the place, but then they'd look at the acreage and the outbuildings and say, this is a lot of work. We just want the house on a city-sized lot. The third group of people we attracted were event planners. These people were going, wow, look, community gardens. We could do pumpkin patches. We could do Christmas trees. We could have a farm stand. This land is beautiful. And then we could have events in the garden and flower beds. And they wanted the whole package. But 5 different offers were withdrawn once they talked with the county, and we were getting conflicting information. One visit, I went back to find out what was going on, and we decided the clerks didn't really understand the regulations, because one time I was told regulations are now allowed. And they took me through. We highlighted and drew arrows, and I took the papers home and said, we can do this. The next visit, I found it was limited to just vineyards, 15 acres and more. I had 6. The state level, I heard, allowed 4 events per year, and the county didn't allow any. I was confused. I went to my representative. She tried to work with the county, and she was unsuccessful, too. So we're wondering, how do we protect farmland and the historic? We are concerned that the historic is taking second seat to environmental issues, and we're concerned that our home and property is cared for and that the next generation will be able to enjoy it too, especially when it's under EFU. I don't think that special events would endanger farmland, but would protect them. It would bring in needed income to the counties. It would sustain structures of historic value. And I ask that you would support this small change in Oregon law to help these rare historic farm properties that are locked in regulations and give them some wiggle room to survive.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Thank you for coming here to share your story, and thank you, Senator, for bringing her here so she can say directly to the committee. Is there any questions for either the Senator or for Ms. Wilson? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we're going to next hear from the Department Conservation Land Development, and then we will go down the list, and we'll start on the 3 minutes. I know that you'll be brief, though, Michael.
Way brief. Thank you. Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Michael Morrissey with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I want to say for the record, we're not against historic sites, and we are not taking a position against this bill, but we do have some concerns, so here briefly is what they are. There are already many Type 2 non-farm uses in statute over 20. They include golf courses and many other types of uses, and so we do have some concerns with expanding the uses of non-farm uses, primary non-farm uses on zoned farmland. I understand that this bill has changed and that the senator tried to narrow the scope. Nonetheless, we're still unsure of the extent of historic property. For example, this says property. It doesn't say buildings only. So I'm not sure if this could include the entire piece of farmland, for example, or not. And if there are any limits to the building or land size. We also tried to get a hold of the State Historic Buildings Organization, SHPO. I'll note that there are evidently 1,800 National Registered sites in the state, and over 1,100 of them are designated century farms. I don't know if century farms qualify somehow. I think the senator is trying to talk about buildings, but again, the scope of this is a little unclear. Other commercial activities is probably the things that bothers us the most at this time. It says weddings and other commercial activities. Again, in other parts of the state, I know other commercial activities either could have included or people tried to get musical venues in, for example, under commercial activities, and I don't know if it allows other types of commercial activities, such as paintball even or recreational vehicles.
Michael, it actually says gatherings. I just want to be clear.
Okay.
And I don't know if there's a difference between activities and gatherings in statute. We would have to
Madam Chair, I'm aware of one very contentious site on forest land in Washington County, which has which is under parks, private parks, and it's a musical venue, and neighbors are quite concerned about the traffic and the noise. So I'm just not clear at this point. I will say that to the extent that the statute and our rules talk about campgrounds and private parks, it's almost all about campgrounds. I'm not really sure what the limits are to parks. I think they're very few and perhaps up to the total discretion of the county once it's declared a private park. I will say we did do a little calling around. We have found some counties that are successfully dealing with weddings, at least under their current county regs and under the home occupation statute that is one of the elements of the non-farm uses. So that's all of ours. And lastly, I'll say, based on what I just heard, I'm not sure if this is the solution here is really to open up the statute for additional use or somehow with the county. I'm not sure what's going on with the county, but... So that's the end of my testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morrissey. Appreciate it. Any questions for the department? I see that we have legal counsel looking over here.
We are both looking at different things. I don't see private parks actually identified in the word and phrases, so I don't know if we have a separate definition that's not going to get picked up.
I didn't see that under the definition, actually, the existing bill.
Madam Chair, in looking, I mean, there's quite a lengthy definition as far as what's historic, what's not, what counts, so on and so forth like that. I think it's very defined, and I would assume that that LCDC really hasn't read the amendment. Is that a correct assumption?
No. I have the brief amendment right here where it ends in describing these things as a private park, if we have the same document.
Yeah, we have the same document. No comment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you. We'll have some more discussions about this. And Beth, do folks have copies of this amendment?
In the back of the room.
So I just wanted to remind folks, we're going to start going down the list right now, that I'm hoping folks have had a chance to look at this amendment because it does amend the original bill, and it may actually change your testimony. So if you haven't, they're in the back right over there.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
Well, before you start, what I'm understanding is that the Chair is entertaining testimony as with the dash ones, not the bill as it was originally written.
Right. So, unfortunately, I know some people haven't had a chance to look at the dash ones, but it does add historic property. It narrows it to historic property. So I just want to make sure folks understand that. It may or may not change your testimony, but keep that in mind when you come up. And next, we're going to be calling up folks first that have traveled over 100 miles. Again, we're going to be limiting to 3 minutes, and if somebody's already stated your position, you are certainly welcome to say, I agree and with that position. So first, I'm just going to go down the list here. We have several folks from Deschutes County. James Gindelsberger, I hope I did not mess up your name too much. Harry Ketronos and Leslie Ketronos. Assuming you guys are related. And then after that, we'll ask Nicole Stevens and Ed Whitelaw to come up, and that'll be the end of our over 100. And just a reminder, if you can state your name for the record, if you have handouts, go to my committee administrator right over there, and welcome. Thanks for traveling so far to come here today.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is James Gindelsberger. I reside at 22985 Someday Way, Bend, Oregon, Deschutes County. First, I'm going to do one thing out of line because you seem to have no definition of private park. The Land Use Board of Appeals has stated there is no definition for the land use board for private parks. But in cases before them, and I quote, private park is a tract of land set aside for public recreational use. That is a Luba case of Dave Tennant versus Polk County. That is, other than minor minor changes to that, that is what they use. This activity that you want that you have to rule on seems to be a very far stretch to say that a wedding is either private or recreational. I happen to live next door to a man who set up one of these wedding venues. I live on 10 acres of land in the country. And when you have 100 to 200 people coming to your neighbor every weekend to have a wedding, it ruins the land. I'm a retired Air Force. I use my retirement money to build a house. I couldn't afford to have a contract to do it. I built it. I poured concrete, I laid walls, I put up ceiling, electrical, plumbing, and now every weekend there's a party next door. I've had to go to court several times for noise, and the judges always rule the same thing. You're making too much noise, and they fine them $450. But when the landowner is getting $3,000 to $5,000 a day to rent his property, he just says, that $450 is a cost of doing business, I don't care. My question is, where is the need? I can't speak for the state, but I know that in Deschutes County there are over 200 locations, legal locations, to have weddings. And historically, Deschutes County holds 1,000 weddings a year. That's from your historical data over the last 5 years. So if we have 200 locations and only 1,100 weddings, why do we need to have more? The wedding cake has only so many pieces in it. And if you create new locations for people to have weddings, you're just stealing the money from businesses that are already set up to have weddings, because there's only so many. You're not drawing that much money in from outside of Oregon to make this to say this is a tourist attraction. We need to draw people from outside. All you do is take a wedding from a golf course and move it to a recreational site. Now, I must admit, with the change to make it only historical, I can see that a bit. I'm not as opposed to that. I'm opposed if this becomes like House Bill 2882, which is going to come up before them. There is no such thing as historical listed on there. It just says anybody can have commercial gatherings on farmland. So this is, I think, it creates a real hazard when you're the guy that lives next door.
Thank you for your comments. And yeah, we have your written testimony, correct?
You do. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. So, Harry and Leslie, maybe you guys can combine your...
No.
You have different testimonies.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members
maybe
of the committee.
Maybe you have a closing testimony.
My name is Harry Katrinas, and I live at 62237 Powell Butte Highway in Bend, Oregon. And I'm an agricultural landowner in Deschutes County, and I'm opposed to SB 325. Weddings and commercial event uses have no place on our agricultural zones due to the tremendous conflicts they present. This proposal is too intense of a use. The agricultural operations has this type of sustained impact on neighbors and has potential for huge impacts on our agriculture economy and producers. You're opening a door for more non-agricultural commercial operations with little regard for the farmers and ranchers who will be negatively impacted, along with legal event businesses. When SB 100 was adopted, just six basic types of uses were allowed in our EFU land. Today, there are over 50 types of uses allowed. We do not need to add more uses to erode the primary purpose of agricultural lands. The purpose of EFU zoning is to preserve and maintain agricultural lands and to serve as a sanctuary for farm uses. Zoning is intended to separate uses and lessen conflicts.
Thank you.
Oregon benefits tremendously from the agricultural industry economy base. Increasing urban pressures threatens to destroy that base and a way of life. I did not understand the impacts of such a proposal until my home was impacted by two illegal event venues that became a living hell, one next door and one over a third of a mile away. The traffic and noise from the events have destroyed the enjoyment of my property. Before purchasing my land over 20 years ago, I read the land uses allowed on my property and the adjacent properties to assure that I would be able to enjoy the peace and tranquility of rural living. That has been denied me and the neighbors.
since these venues have moved in. Windows vibrate from amplified noise, and I take my life in my own hands, driving the rural roads to traffic congestion. Drinking and driving caused by these events. Sleep has been impossible every weekend from May until late September due to the noise events. This legislature does not belong as a park use, which is recreation, nor does it belong on agricultural lands. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
Great. Thank you, and yeah. You did it under 3 minutes. We're impressed.
All right.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Okay. My name is Leslie Katrinas. I am an agricultural landowner, 62237 Talbot Road, Bend, Oregon, Deschutes County. And thank you for hearing my testimony today. I am opposed to SB 325 for the following reasons, and now I know that it has an amendment, but I'm still going to say there's impacts, and a lot of these are the same impacts, whether it's going to be on the historic lands or anything. I think it violates statewide goals 3 and 14 to preserve and protect our farmland and contain urban commercial activities within the urban growth boundary. It erodes the primary purpose of farmland. It opens the door for increased urbanization, commercialization of agricultural lands. Agricultural landowners are already allowed supplemental income through the home occupation codes designed to blend with the agriculture zone. Greening of America, locally raising of our foods will be compromised with lands used for commercial event purposes. Groundwater contamination from nitrates. We're talking rural lands where there is no sewer systems. It has septic systems. It stresses impacts on animal, livestock, reproduction, and weight gains. It interferes with the accepted farm uses such as fertilizing, spraying for weeds, animal reproduction, increased dangers to livestock handlers, i.e. the applause, yelling, startles animals, causing them to react in unexpected ways. Compaction of the soil from vehicles compromised farm soils. Oil and other vehicle engine leaks building up over time in our farm soils, increased traffic on rural roads, fire concerns in areas that are not in fire districts, increased fire hazard from catalytic converters and smoking, noxious weeds spreading even from other states as people come in from all over for these events. Loss of privacy, peace and quiet to the area from excessive traffic and large party noises. Loss of enjoyment of property to neighbors forced to listen to amplified commercial urban noise late into the nights instead of the soothing rural night sounds. It increases urban pressures on our wildlife, desensitizing them. Noise, people impacts on raptors and nocturnal wildlife hunting. There's no resources to monitor events. Deschutes County Sheriff, since we've been battling this for 2 years up there, is on record against similar legislation in the Deschutes County. That's TA-089. Farmers go to bed early, plus other occupation work, odd hours, nurses, police officers. These events interfere with their rest. There's glare from the vehicle, glass, white tents, and furnishings. Thank you for your time. I think that covers most of it. I did turn in pictures so that you can see what these actually look like on our farmlands.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you coming all this way to share your thoughts with us, and we have your written testimony as well.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is, wrong one. Next up is Nicole. Is that right? And then also Ed Whitelaw. Is Ed here? Why don't you come on up, because you drove far to get here today. And actually then Bob Horning. I didn't know if that was Washington State or Washington County. Welcome. Thanks for being here. And just a reminder, state your name, and then we'll give you 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Environmental and Natural Resource Committee. My name is Nicole Stevens. I am very concerned that our agricultural lands are being raped by putting additional uses on lands that are to be protected from urban commercialization according to state land use goals. I am not seeing in this bill where all the land use laws would apply. It is my understanding that OR 660.033 says private parks must be on EFU lands that are not high-value irrigated farmlands. Our state land use codes were enacted to protect farmlands. A provision was made for additional revenue to agricultural land owners with home occupational code, which protects neighbors from impacts and conflicts of uses. If these activities do not fit under the home occupation or mass gathering codes, they are too intensive and invasive to neighbors to be allowed use. This bill opens the door to many unintended consequences, as an event could be many things as long as it isn't overnight. That allows for any event, music festivals, NASCAR races, motorcycle rallies. You name it, the door is wide open. They can participate all hours so long as they don't lodge on the site. Will the venue operators push park use since ERTs are allowed on private parks in the same paragraph? You betcha. The event center near us provides a room for bride and groom's wedding night. Who is going to monitor these event centers? Resources can only be stretched so far. These are not a recreational park activity, but commercial business. Commercial activities belong in the areas that have been zoned for them. They belong in the home occupation or mass gathering codes, not as private parks, which are for recreation use. Weddings and commercial events are not recreational in any sense of the word. Thank you for your opportunity to let me testify today.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Questions? We'll take questions at the end if there are some questions.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Ed Whitelaw, and I've submitted some written testimony prepared by two colleagues of mine, a guy named Bryce Ward, who lives in Portland, and Andrew Kenny, who's over here. My wife and I have 10 acres outside Bend in Deschutes County, and we are economists. So what
I've done... We won't hold that against you. We have
I offered that as a softball for
We have one of your colleagues. Yes, yes. We won't hold that against you.
So in any event, what we did was focus on the economics of this since I've been following the process in Deschutes County, and the economic arguments and evidence offered so far are weak. So I'm going to just try to get across a couple of concepts, and the written testimony gives our backgrounds enough for the purposes of this testimony, I think. First, the proper question from an economist would be, what are the net economic effects of not passing the Senate bill? I'm not addressing the amendment. I'm not addressing the House bill counterpart. So what we tried to do was focus on the beneficiaries, who are rather few, and their estimates, at least in Deschutes County, we could not find estimates elsewhere, of the so-called economic benefits that they calculated. One of them is $44,250 per wedding event, estimating the, or including the gross expenditures all the way from liquor, flowers, the pastor, and so on. And they then extrapolated this to something on the order of $5 million per, I don't know if it was a year or whatever. But the error is, that is not the net economic effect to the state. What's important to calculate is what would be the difference without that handful of EFU wedding venues occurring in Deschutes County or the expansion to the state. And it is virtually zero. And the reason is there is competition and there are partial and complete substitutes throughout the state for those alternatives.
Great. And you have that summarized in, or
yes,
written in your testimony. I know you just gave a summary. We appreciate it. We appreciate the economic perspective. Okay. You have to slide the mic over there. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you. I'm a Bob Horning, owner of the Horning's Hideout, the private park that Luba just, or the land use just said I was contentious, the owner up there in Washington County and everything. We have actually been through a very, very, very rigorous land use process recently, last few years, to expand our uses and everything else. When I first read this bill, I was very much opposed to it because it, the way it was written, opens up the door wide open to a lot of abuses and everything else. With the land use process in place, it does keep, you know, protects neighbors, it does protect, you know, the patrons and everything else. You know, our place, you know, we have to follow various rules and regulations and everything else, noise ordinances, all the stuff we all comply with and everything else up there. We do a lot of different things. We are a private park. Now, a private park, under a LUBA ruling of Spearing versus Yamhill County, means that you can basically do anything in the, that you've done in a private park, you can do in a private a public park, you can do in a private park. Weddings, whatever it is, it's not just limited to recreational uses. That's a mistake by a lot of folks speaking here. It's already been settled in courts and everything else. Okay, so you can have multitude of gatherings and everything else in a private park. Okay, well, I say as written, I very much oppose the proposed amendment. With the new amendment, I'm torn a little bit. If it inserted the historic buildings and in there, and if it changed around to where the buildings could not be torn down, if they were removed or something like that, there they'd lose their status. And it, instead of it is a private park, which designates somebody right away as a private park, and instead it says something like may be a private park pursuant to 215.296, which stipulates all the regulations that's needed as far as protecting land use and people around them. It's not that bad, you know, in my point of view. As written, I wouldn't touch if I were you, you know, armor centers and everything else. Because it does make a class of citizen by itself, somebody who owns a certain amount of property, and you designate them as a special class citizen. I don't think that should be. Also, if you want to throw in there or talk about buildings, you know, a lot of counties are do not include, allow weddings to be had, you know, done in buildings or anything else in private parks. Or anything you may want to, if associate, say something about associated buildings. I said that at the bottom of my testimony here, you know, my written testimony. I've gone way off this because I say the dynamics of the discussion has changed. So,
okay, perfect timing. All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Just a comment. I've been in this committee for 10 years, two centuries, and I don't think I've ever heard an economist talk about the land use system. That's very unusual. Thank you for coming. I really enjoyed. What's your name?
Ed Whitelaw.
You're from MIT. MIT, Harvard.
That was long ago.
What's that?
That was a long time ago.
Take it. Own it.
He's now finding duck.
Yeah.
I'm a duck for the last 4 decades.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that. And last second comment, I really feel here for Mrs. Wilson. I would say that probably 15 to 20% of my caseload is people who can't navigate our statewide land use system. And it's just a nightmare. Nope, the county doesn't understand, and the state always says no, and so people are usually left hanging.
For dealing with the problem she faces, 325 is a very blunt instrument.
Well, unfortunately, citizens almost always have to resort to blunt instruments because they can never get answers through the department.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Senator, and appreciate it. We also appreciate you sending one of your colleagues over here, by the way. Representative Jules Coble Bailey, who I know you've worked with. Yeah, you may want to wait a little bit until he's has
he's
a chance
graying.
To recover.
He's graying.
Yeah, we noticed he didn't have any gray hair when he got here either, like some other public folks. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to hear from Jim Kessinger, Sean Cleave, and then Art Schlack. Sean, Art, you want to come up? Okay.
Don't be bashful.
Yeah, don't be shy. We don't bite. Okay, thank you, Mr. Kissinger, if you want to get started, and you can just state your name for the record.
So my name is Jim Kessinger. I'm a farmer in Multnomah County near Skyline Aquinas Pass. I have a business called Plumper Pumpkin Patch and Tree Farm, and I don't do weddings, and I don't want to do weddings. My wife would probably divorce me if I did weddings. But I supported the original wording of the – well, let me tell you a little bit more. I do field trips, a lot of school field trips, and that's an important part of my business because I during the weekdays I'll get these school kids and busloads of kids, and they all go home with a little sticker, and they tell their folks, and they got to bring their brother or sister on the weekend. And so the field trips during the week help me sell, you know, and they go away with a pumpkin or whatever. But the field trips during the week help me sell pumpkins on the weekend and help me, you know, bring people to the farm and sell whatever. So doesn't have much to do with weddings, does it? But the original wording of the bill mentioned commercial activities, and so I'm exploring the wonders of the land use system now, and so I'm involved in that, and I'm kind of a neophyte in it, perhaps. But it seems like there's some unclarity whether things like, you know, what is a field trip like that? You know, I get requests from teachers for field trips, and so I try to, they help me design them. I try to provide them as a service and as a way of providing an opportunity for the kids and the families to come out and see what a farm looks like. So, but it seems like the, you know, what is a field trip on a, I have 65 acres and, what is it? Is it a farm activity? Is it in the 75-25% thing? Is it the part of the 25? Is it a, you know, what is it? So I saw the wording of the original before the amendment. I saw it as a way of possibly clarifying that that would be an allowed use and would not be penalized for being successful at field trips. So I don't support the way the amendment has been worded. Narrows the scope of the bill to historic properties. Well, my barn's 120 years old, but I'm not in the, as far as I know, I don't think I am, in the National Historic Registry. I assume not. I've owned it for 20 years myself, or since 93, whatever that is. So the narrowing of the bill, I think, detracts from the benefit. I think, you know, some of these people have some legitimate complaints about these weddings. I wouldn't want to live next to such a venue myself, but I think there's ways of handling it. I think by adding verbiage at the state level, it provides opportunities to standardize between counties what the how to handle these things. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing your testimony, and I will say that I'm one of those pesky cyclists that cycles past your farm, so certainly appreciate meeting the owner. Thanks for coming today.
Great. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Working Counties, and let me start out by saying I just saw the -1 amendments, and I think they make some improvements in the proposal at this point by putting some sideboards and further clarifying at least the intended activities. However, I would express some concern about the phrase other commercial gatherings at this point. I think that's pretty broad. I'm concerned that this will again become somewhat of a contentious local land use interpretation, and so it would be helpful if we could work on that definition. Also, would point out that there is something that we call mass gatherings, and there is a body of law around mass gatherings. There are activities that have been talked about here today that take place under the mass gathering provisions of statute and local registration, local ordinances at this point. This is proposed to be a sub 2 use. I think that's positive from the standpoint it would require a local conditional use permit and review of the proposal to put some additional sideboards
to address such things as transportation impacts, health safety kinds of issues, and those kinds of things, which are also reviewed with mass gatherings. Finally, what I would suggest is I'm not sure I would call this a private park. I think that if the legislature looks at it, this is a use that they would like to provide under the sub 2 list of uses, that it be singled out as weddings and other kinds of things within a historic building located within the exclusive farm use zone. I think that would be better than trying to define this and maybe other uses as under the private park piece. Then finally, Madam Chair, there are two provisions in statute dealing with exclusive farm use. There's 215, 213 dealing with marginal lands. There are two counties that are marginal land counties, and they have exclusive farm use zoning underneath that, and it's covered in a different section of the statute. So if the committee is looking at this as an appropriate sub 2 use, I would suggest that you allow it both in ORS 215, 213, and ORS 215, 283. That would cover all 36 counties rather than only maybe 34 of the 36. The two marginal land counties are Washington and Lane. Thank you.
Great. Sean.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. Thanks for having me today. Testifying on behalf of Oregon Farm Bureau on Senate Bill 325. The Farm Bureau has a longstanding tradition of opposing additional uses that wouldn't be connected to an agricultural industry in the 215 statute, which this is proposed to be part of. Mr. Schlack provided a lot of good points in his testimony, and I don't mean to be redundant. I did provide as part of my testimony today two documents. One is a copy of the regulation of outdoor mass gatherings. I would agree with Mr. Schlack that perhaps that might be a better statute to address these types of activities. It does deal with transportation and impacts on surrounding agricultural activities and health and safety issues. So that's there for the committee's reference. Secondly, on the top of the packet I handed in was just a story of the week that was highlighted by the Department of Agriculture describing how agriculture in Oregon is actually an industry that has saw some economic growth over the last year. And the reason why I've included that, inevitably, any time a conversation comes up about modifying the 215 statute for permitted and conditional use, the term economic development is thrown around, and the Farm Bureau has a position that we're an industry as well. We contribute to the economy. Actually, we're the second largest economic driver in the state as far as the sector goes. Anytime we take land out of production or create a system where there may be conflicts between landowners, that adds a potential to minimize that economic impact for the state of Oregon. And with that, I'll close my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next up, we have, is it Alec Jensen with the Tualatin Valley Fire Department and Eric McMullen with the McMinnville Fire Department? And then, actually, because we're just trying to move through, I'm going to call up Danielle from Thousand Friends as well. Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alec Jensen with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'll be brief. I'm here neither in support or in opposition of the bill, but rather to raise one concern we have. And before I do that, however, I want to acknowledge Senator Metzger and his staff for speaking to us about this, being empathetic. And it may be that our issue has already been resolved, but we want to get into the record that we do have this concern. Under current practices, if somebody in EFU land wants to use their property, or more importantly, the ag buildings or residences on their property for a described use. They go through the conditional use process, and the local building official, in cooperation with the local fire department, will make sure that the fire and life safety code provisions are met, things like access and firefighting water supply and exiting and those sorts of things. And the question we have, we're fairly confident it's resolved and non-issue, but like I said, we wanted to get in the record. The question or concern we have is that in an outright use, that may not be covered. And we have some assurances from Senator Metzger's office that, in fact, our concern is valid, that we will work through that and make sure that those concerns are addressed.
All right, thank you. Did you have anything you'd like to add?
Okay. Ditto.
Why don't you just state your name for the record, though?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric McMullen, representing the Oregon Fire Marshals Association and McMinnville Fire Department, and I just echo Mr. Jensen's testimony.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Any questions before we release this gentleman? Senator Boquist.
One comment, Madam Chair, in reading the bill and the existing law, I think this would still be a conditional use permit. It would still have to be, the governing body of the county would still have to approve it.
That's my understanding, but thank you for the clarification. Okay.
Thank you,
gentlemen. Danielle?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Welver. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director of 4,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on Senate Bill 325. That would add commercial wedding businesses and other commercial gatherings as a use allowed in the exclusive farm use zone. This proposal is not about whether a couple can get married on the farm. It is about authorizing commercial gatherings, including commercial wedding businesses, as a new use on farmland. There is no limit to the type, frequency, or size of these gatherings in this proposal, and it authorizes new structures to be built for those commercial businesses. This means that a farm could even turn into a concert arena. The purpose of the EFU zone is to contain conflicts that are costly to Oregon family farmers. It is easy to see fields and pastures as bucolic settings for a wedding, but the EFU zone is at heart an industrial zone. Wedding businesses and other gatherings that are unrelated to farming do not belong in this zone. The conflicts are many and cost farmers income, and many of those have been enumerated already, so I won't go into that. Oregon's farmers try to be good neighbors and routinely absorb the extra cost of rescheduling their business activities to accommodate others. In practice, commercial gathering businesses would trump the needs of family farmers, who comprise over 99% of all Oregon farms. It seems prudent in these times to protect the industry that remains stable, remains in Oregon, and provides safe food and jobs for Oregonians. Few industries can still make these claims. Each weakening of farmland protections converts to less profit for Oregon families that make their living off the land. We respectfully ask that you do not support this legislation.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Danielle. And I have a question. Have you had a chance to look at the dash one?
Yes, we have, and we still oppose the bill. Okay.
All right, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you. Okay, and we have a few more folks who would like to testify. Andrew Stamp, John Moore, and Jennifer Sturm. Okay, come on up. Let's start with you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Stamp. I'm a land use attorney for a nursery and vineyard in Aurora named Grower Direct, and I'm also here on behalf of Plumper Pumpkin. You heard from my client Jim Kessinger earlier today. We were pleased to see the original bill, thinking it would be a great thing for family farms, but the Dash 1 amendments obviously thwarted our pleasure for the bill. Under current Oregon law, commercial wedding venues and corporate events are generally not allowed on resource zones. If you have a winery, in some counties they will approve them, but probably if that was ever taken to LUBA, it would probably get overturned. School field trips and corporate events are generally also not part of a farm stand use, although you see them happen all the time. What we have now is we have a lot of different situations in counties where some counties are approving weddings for wineries, and then you have a lot of wineries that are using weddings illegally. You know, for example, I know you all know Willamette Valley Vineyards. They've got a huge facility out there. When I did research into this, I checked. They have no permits for that kind of thing. King Estate, St. Joseph's, Oak Knoll, they all advertise for weddings. None of them actually have permits. They're just not allowed. There are some that have gotten approved as home occupations. Some have gotten approved probably incorrectly, but no one appealed it. We heard a lot of testimony today from people opposing what sounds like are a lot of illegal wedding venues that occur out on the lands. But from my standpoint, I think if an applicant comes in for a conditional use permit, actually goes through the conditional use permit where you have to evaluate impacts on neighbors, those sorts of things would be taken care of. In addition, because it's a dash two use under 283, it would have to comply with 215-296, which says requires the applicant to show that they will not force a significant change in accepted farm and forest practices, nor will they significantly increase the cost of accepted farm and forest practices. Those are pretty difficult tests to meet. There was a discussion about private parks. Under dash two, there's two types of uses, commercial activities in conjunction with farm use and private parks, which are not very well defined in the statute. But private parks have been included paintball facilities and motocross, but no Luvacases approved wedding facilities. So I disagree with the testimony that you could get a wedding approved as a private park under current law. It's simply not a recreational activity within the meaning of a park. Therefore, I would support amendments that would limit these types, that would allow these types of uses on certain farm properties. And if you're worried about impact, the way to deal with that is to require enough land, maybe 40 acres, 60 acres, or require some sort of income test similar to dwellings, like a $40,000 income test to make sure that you prove that the person doing it is actually a bona fide farmer, those type of things. With those limitations in place, I think it is possible to allow weddings on EFU land, which is currently not allowed. And I disagree with the testimony that says this is not about people who just want to have a wedding out in the country. If I wanted to have a wedding out in the country right now, I can't do it because I don't know any farmers who are just going to let me have a wedding out on their farm for free. So I think this is a matter of fairness for people that do want to have a wedding out in the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And just a quick question, if you had any comments on I don't know if you saw the dash one amendments.
Didn't see them until I got here today. Obviously, they're very disappointing. That probably someone said it applies to maybe 10 or 12 houses. That probably sounds about right. I think it would basically make it a bill just for one person. I think that's. I think the bill ought to be more broad than that.
All right. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead next, John?
We have Jennifer speak next.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Jennifer Sturm. I am here in support of Bill 325. I did not hear about the added amendment until now. I'm opposed to the amendment but for Bill 325, and I'm hoping that you guys will support Bill 325 as well. My family has a farmland. We have 51 acres, 17 of it around there. It does weddings. I had my wedding out there, and it was beautiful. We were respectful. I have wonderful memories. I didn't get a single complaint. I was gone by 9. I believe the party ended by 10, and no neighbors ever complained about it. The farmland is spectacular, and I feel it's a shame that only my family and myself can take advantage of that type of beauty. I wish my friends could come out and do it. It's expensive to upkeep a farm and let people use it for free, but I am for adding some sort of bill that would allow us to have weddings out there. I feel like it would be beneficial for more than just myself.
Okay. Right, thank you. Ms. Moore?
John Moore, I'm the owner at Grower Direct, and she was a beautiful bride as well as my daughter, and I thought it might be helpful if you heard that. I feel like John McCain before the election. When I kept sitting there saying, why don't you ask Senator Obama if you can borrow your way into national prosperity? He never asked that question. And maybe today our testimony won't go any farther than Senator McCain's campaign, but I want to talk to you from the standpoint of a farmer. By day, I'm a lawyer, but I also own 51 acres, and we farm shrubs and trees and turf, and you have a flyer for our farm. And we do a multiple kinds of things on the farm. We sell wholesale and retail, but we have 15 or 20 employees, and I sign payroll checks every month. folks, and I'm about ready to start laying people off in this economy. And at some point, it's the economy, and allowing people to use the farmland in a way that is consistent and neighborly to those around us, but allows for people to come out and benefit from gatherings in the country, is something that I think Oregon should be in the lead of instead of resisting. So there are two parts to my testimony. First of all, as a farm owner, it's economically beneficial to take portions of the farm and allow for commercial activities that are all under the auspices of the county, whether it's building codes or the fire department, whoever it is, and we deal with all of those folks. The other thing that strikes me, and Andrew tried to speak to this, and I trust that it made an impact, is that right now we have some counties that are allowing weddings on the same kind of applications that other counties are not. So here's our problem. You're at the tip of an iceberg, and you either need to say no as to all weddings commercially in the state of Oregon, because that's where it's going. Complaints are going to start flying against all the vineyards that are illegally having commercial weddings now, or you need to say yes. It's a commercial activity that can happen on farmland. We're only at the tip of the iceberg today in terms of whether U.S. statewide are going to allow it or not allow it. Thank you for the testimony. We testify in support of the bill.
Thank you all. Yeah. Before you go, let's see if there's any questions, though, for my colleagues. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your testimony. And last, we have Peter Kanagi, Benton County. And then is there anybody else who would like to testify on this that did not sign up? That's on Senate Bill 325. Okay. You're up last.
Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity.
State your name, please?
Peter Kanagi. I'm a farmer in Benton County, farm about 325 acres of commercial vegetables and seed crops. I'm opposed to Senate Bill 325, and we really don't need additional non-farm uses. We have enough conflicts the way it is. The amendments make the bill more palatable, but I still have hesitations with them, and I think it's the wrong avenue to address Mrs. Wilson's problems. When one hears her story, it would appear that, you know, what she proposes makes sense for her situation. Addressing the problem this way is the wrong way to do it. We're opening up vast amounts of land to commercial gatherings if we do this, and that's going to be a lot of headaches for a lot of farmers down the road. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming here today and sharing your concerns. Okay, with nobody else signed up, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325. And next, I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 629. And Beth, if you can give us a review of the bill, let's let folks trickle out.
Senate Bill 629 requires the State Department of Agriculture to establish a grant program for assisting counties in carrying out weed control district duties, functions, and powers.
And I guess this is Senator Firioli's bill? That
yes. It was my understanding that he was in the process of traveling, but I just made it back in time.
Okay. All right. Well,
so I do think his main proponent is here.
Okay. And that is Don Furr. Yeah. All right, Don, you want to come up and provide an introduction? Where are you? There you go. And actually, I'll ask the Department of Agriculture to come up as well in case there's any questions. And I'm sure there will be. I know I saw somebody, I think Lisa's here. Hey, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelter and the committee. This is new to me, so if I make a mistake, please bear with me.
We'll try to make it easy for you.
Yeah,
you just say your name. And
okay. My name is Don Farrar.
Thank you.
I'm with the Gillum County Weed Department, and I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 629. Maybe I can give you a little background first. ORS 570 was established a number of years ago to allow counties to have enforcement to control noxious weeds on private property. I couldn't find the exact date that bill was ever established, but it has to be at least 50 years old. In about the 1980s, we had some funding that came from the Oregon Department of Ag through general fund dollars to fund county weed programs or to assist county weed programs. Ballot Measure 5 pretty much did away with those. And I'm kind of jumping here, but
that's okay.
In 1999, the Oregon Department of Ag and some of the shareholders were asked to develop a strategic plan for the for the state of Oregon. And we established that plan with one of the priorities being, again, to fund county weed programs. They haven't been funded by then. Then we jump ahead to 2008, and we were asked, I sat on the Oregon Invasive Species Council Board, and we were asked to come up with a plan for invasive species in Oregon. And the weed programs come to the top again. Since counties have basically have the enforcement right that ORS 570 originally gave us, we need to get counties established with weed programs. And so that's where Senate Bill 629 comes in. At this time, I would like to say that we did want to amend the funding portion out of that bill. And do you have a, everybody has a copy? Do you want me to?
Beth
can explain it if you'd like. We don't. It's being drafted with LC. Yeah. It's been turned in, but we don't have the actual amendment back yet.
Okay. So basically, if you have that bill in front of you, we would like to drop Section 2 in its entirety, and then Section 3, Part 4, and all of that out of it. So basically, it takes all the funding out of the bill and just leaves a mechanism for ODA to get funding to county weed programs if it becomes available.
Okay.
Hopefully money will become available because this is kind of critical for us at this point. From the invasive standpoint, it's really difficult to protect Oregon if you have some counties that don't have active weed programs or have created weed districts. And in your packet, there's a map of Oregon. And it should show you a problem. There's one correction on this map, and that's Coos County didn't send in their information, and they do have some kind of weed program, but I don't know what that is currently. One of the problems we're going to have here is if an invasive plant was to come, say, up I-5, we would end up stopping in Marion County because that's the only county that has a weed district that's created to be able to stop farm machinery, that kind of thing, from moving through the state. So basically what this 629 will do will help us hopefully create weed departments in every county in the state of Oregon. And with that, I'll ask for questions.
Okay, and then the agency, are you here? Would you like to comment on it, or are you here more to answer questions?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We're here as a resource for the committee and to provide background on the current grant program, if that would be the committee's pleasure.
I think that would be helpful.
I brought with me one of the technical experts, Tim Butler, who runs our noxious weed program, and I'll ask him to provide you some of that background, please.
Thank you.
Yes, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, again, my name is Tim Butler. I manage the noxious weed control program at the Department of Agriculture. As far as some of the background on the grant program, and we currently have a noxious weed control grant program that with Measure 66 funds that was appropriated by the legislature during the 99-01 biennium. And those grants are to go towards supporting private landowners, the tribes, soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, cooperative weed management areas and counties in for noxious weed management around the state. And those are for specific projects that go towards watershed enhancement, fish and wildlife protection activities, and those types of things. So it's a very specific dollars that go towards supporting those efforts. Currently, we have about there's about this for the 07-09 biennium. There's $2.3 million available that goes through the department and is awarded by the Oregon State Weed Board in grants. And so this last biennium or this biennium, currently we've funded 124 grants totaling $1.9 million. And we've received over 223 proposals, totaling $3.7 million. So there's a much greater demand for these grants than dollars that are available. So that's kind of a quick overview on the grant program as a whole. That has helped to take us, I think, in the right direction as far as implementing the Oregon Noxious Weed Strategic Plan that Mr. Farrar referred to, that was presented to the legislature in 2001. But we're still looking to have stable funding for county weed control programs statewide.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for the department? I have some, so don't leave yet. And, you know, some of you may know, I know Lisa does, I'm a former Soil and Water Conservation District employee, Washington County. Mm-hmm. We're in Senator Hass's district. A question I have, because I'm not as familiar with the weed boards, obviously Washington County didn't have one, as you see there in the pink. So, and I read the report, I didn't serve on the Invasive Species Council and support, as you know, certainly eradication of weeds and invasive species, a big problem for the state. The concern that I have, and this has come up in the Ways and Means Subcommittee discussions on the Department of Ag's budget, is looking at what's the best mechanism to deliver those grants if we have funding, which is a big if, as you know. And the question, I guess, that rises to the top of the discussion is, who is the best delivery of those services? And we have how many soil and water conservation districts throughout the state? I should know that. 42. We have 90 watershed councils, mm-hmm. and then we have weed boards in some counties, but not all. Obviously, we have areas, part of big chunks of the state that aren't served. So was there discussion about that, how we can look at triage or combining resources? Certainly, weeds don't stop at county boundaries. Oftentimes, they're spread through watershed because oftentimes they're spread via streams during flooding. I certainly have had my share of Japanese knotweed, mm-hmm. and I know that a lot of that was spread through the Tualatin Basin in the floods. So if you have some comments on that, that's what I'm struggling with, as we have very limited resources to see how we can serve the citizens of Oregon better, and looking at ways that we can combine resources where possible. So I'd appreciate a comment from all of you on this.
That's a really tough question. Knowing the budget trends and after walking around the Capitol for a few days and talking to folks,
you're really
depressing,
positive,
isn't it?
It's not uplifting. Yes. Well, and that's the question.
I mean, really do not know the means of getting funding for us. I just do not. I thought we had something sort of worked out originally with this funding package, but really those weren't the best dollars to fit us. So in reality, what we taking that funding out is probably the best, but I just don't know where to go for that type of funding.
I guess my follow-up is, so where does this bill get you if there's no funding?
Well, it does get us a mechanism, so if we find funding, we can move forward.
And the current mechanism doesn't work. I mean, I'd like to hear from the department on that.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think one of the challenges we have in the current grant program, it's Measure 66 capital dollars, mm-hmm. and those dollars have to be used for on-the-ground projects. What this bill does is set up an infrastructure, mm-hmm. basically, for those counties to have staff available to do some of this work, and I think ultimately would make them more competitive in some of the grant programs by having that infrastructure available to them. But the current funding in our grant program doesn't fit for this type of a use.
So I guess my follow-up to that is, we have watershed council staff, we have soil and water conservation staff, And I'm looking, going, well, are we going to fund additional staff at the county level? And is there any way to do some triage here, since we're looking at probably several years out at best where we will have the funding for more staff? And I'm not saying we don't need more staff, but I'm trying to figure out how we can work within our existing programs and our limited staff.
Madam Chair, if I may add a comment. Again, for the record, Tim Butler, Department of Agriculture. There is a lot of cooperation that's currently going on, and in many cases, in some counties, the SWCDs actually function as the weed control district. And so, and that, as far as in statute under ORS 570 through 600, it allows the county to designate a county weed control district. They can, in turn, pass that responsibility on to the soil and water conservation districts, which has taken place in some counties. So it just depends on the county as far as the format on how that work is taking place. And but the bottom line is, the important part is to have a county-based program, county weed district in every county. Currently, we only have, and you have the map, I think it's about 21 out of the 36 counties that are active at this point. So there's a lot of gaps out there.
Okay, and just as a last point, I mean, we will not be necessarily gaining more counties if we don't have funding. I mean, what incentive is there at this point? That's what I'm trying to just figure out, and I'm not saying I think certainly anything we can do to reduce weeds, noxious species, is a good thing, but I just want to make sure we're not duplicating efforts. So if you have one last comment on that.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, I think, the agency is here to provide background information. We're not taking a position on the bill. It's not incorporated in the governor's recommended budget. And so we understand the challenges that you have with this, and I think maybe Mr. Farrar would be better suited to talk about that intent from his perspective.
Well, with the current budget cycle, I look at it and I just don't know how you would do that. I don't know how we get that funding right away. We tend to look to you folks every time we need money, and I guess that's a difficult part of this whole program. Some of our counties have went ahead and funded themselves, but the critical thing here is getting that carrot, giving those counties that have nothing, giving them something to get them going. And it's a terrible struggle, because obviously my county doesn't want to give that up, to some other county, but we will fund my county. So I don't know how we get those people on board without offering them something, and I still do not know where that funding comes from.
Okay. Well, one thing that would be helpful, and I'm going to ask the department for this, if you can provide, I want to see where the overlays are between soil and water conservation districts and the county weed board. So if you can get me a map that shows those two areas, I think the whole committee would probably appreciate that.
Okay. And in my county, my SWCD board is my county weed board. So it's exactly what Tim mentioned earlier. We function well together that way. I think it's probably a wise move to have every cooperator you can in the same room at the same time. So.
Okay. All right, great. Well, thank you for coming here today, and I'm sure we'll have some other questions. Appreciate your testimony.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thanks. And we have about 23 minutes left and about 8 people who'd like to testify. So I'm going to ask people again if you can keep your comments to 3 minutes. And certainly if you have testimony, written testimony, if you can paraphrase that, please. Dave Pranger, Alan Schnetsky, did I get that right? And Gil Riddell. Dave, you want to get started?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Pranger from Heppner, Oregon, and I am the County Weed Control Supervisor for Morrow County. I'm born and raised in Washington County, though, so I do have some ties over on this side of the mountain as well. I had a couple things that I wanted to touch on, but maybe I can share a little bit of background on the question that you were dealing with before. I've been doing this for about this is my 20th year now, And when I first started out, I first started working through the Soil and Water Conservation District. I was a Soil and Water Conservation District employee at that time. About 5 years into that, though, we started getting into budget crunches and trying to see where, you know, we could spread people out a little bit thinner and, you know, give them more hats to wear, I guess. And what I eventually came up with was I eventually evolved into a road department employee. You know, this may work in some instances for some counties and may not be as well as work as well for others, but it allowed me to wear several hats at that time, you know, thus still maintaining a presence of a weed control district in Morrill County, but then also I also do like the paint striping for the road department, and I do other things for the road department at that, you know, also. But my primary function there is the weed control supervisor for the county, and so any weed questions, you know, regarding noxious weeds in Morrill County come through me. And one of the primary reasons I saw to put the get the weed control district moved over into through the road department was that roads is actually one of the key areas which our noxious weeds travel. You know, I've heard estimates, you know, 90% of our weed control problems are spread along our roadways and emanate from and start from our roadways. And so if you have a road department employee out there taking care of weed control on roadways and stuff, he's out there all the time, all during the year. You see where the problems are starting, you take care of them at that point before they get a chance to spread. It has really worked out well for our county, I believe. I guess that's what I wanted to say about that aspect of it, you know. The other aspect I had was the use of county weed control personnel in assisting the Department of Ag with their activities, such as the distribution of biocontrol agents and stuff, because it does take a while to you need to get those distributed right away, and if you have somebody in the county which they can go to, it's really helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan?
Yeah, hi, I'm Alan Chinetsky. I'm the Wallowa County Vegetation Manager from Enterprise, also fifth generation farmer rancher on our family's 125-year-old farm. So noxious weeds have been a part of my life and my family's life for generations. And the thing that I really want to iterate, it like one of you had commented, is that the weeds know no boundaries. And what we experience in Wallowa County is a noxious weed, yellow star thistle. And it has come in from both the Washington and Idaho sides of their states, and has come in and invaded our Hell's Canyon area. And we've had an active weed board in our county since 1921, and we take weeds very seriously. So these weeds coming in, we were right on top of it and able to prevent those from really taking a stronghold in our county. And with the passing of this bill, you know, if we can just get it out there that we need weed control districts in all of the counties in the state of Oregon, because if we don't, you know, we're gonna lose a big battle here. Everybody needs to work together. And another thing that we've got going in Wallowa County is we've got a hay quarantine. Our whole county is a hay quarantine area, and we developed it in 1985. So, it's unlawful to bring any hay into Wallowa County that is not certified weed-free hay. And you know, we're kind of leading the way on this program, and you know, we all need you know, help with funding and everything, as we said. But, you know, if we could, you know, just I just all work together and get this thing through, it'd be really good.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We appreciate the committee's attention to this problem and appreciate your comments, Madam Chair. It's too bad we have to talk about triage. Too bad we can't deal with it strategically in an effective way, but anything at this point will help. Thank you.
So I'm assuming you support the bill. Yes. I see you put it down there. And I will say that I don't think triage necessarily needs to be a bad thing, but we are in a situation where we have very limited resources, and I think we have to be really creative. And having worn many hats with the Watershed Council and SWCD, I certainly understand the challenges we have. So one question I had actually for the department, and I'm wondering, maybe you gentlemen know the answer to this. Is there no USDA funding that comes through? We have NRCS funding, you know, for many, many programs, as you know, CRP, CREP, many programs. Is there no USDA funding that comes through that are available for counties that can be passed down through the state that you know of? And
The NRCS has had a grant that one of our weed management areas, the Tri-County Weed Management Area, which is Baker, Union, Wallowa Counties, I know that they filed, or they applied for some of that money and was able to get some funding through the NRCS, which was federal money.
Okay. And I'll ask the department to follow up, if you could, with that. It would be helpful. Okay, any questions from the panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, for coming all the way here today. Appreciate that. Dan Sherwin, Tanya Beard, and Vern Holm. All right, somebody just go, because we're running out of time.
I'm Dan Sherwin from Deschutes County Vegetation Manager, and I support this bill. I'm going to talk a little bit about, we've talked a little bit about the money has to be used on the ground from the state program. Mm-hmm. And my program in Deschutes County, we didn't have a program till 2002. So my program is only 7 years old, and most of the people in Deschutes County, when I got there, didn't even know what spotted knapweed or any of the noxious weeds were. So my focus in the last 7 years has been education and prevention. And I've actually worked with the Department here of Agriculture at the State Fair doing education programs. We have a weed wagon that we haul around the state to educate the folks. And there is no funding from the state for education and prevention. It's mainly for on-the-ground work that has to be done. And we do get some funds from Deschutes County, from the Oregon State Weed Board. But the education part of the program is not funded. I do get some funding, or I have, from the Forest Service through grant processes. But at this point, the money is dwindling from year to year. It was up into the $50,000 areas, and last year we got $16,000, and part of that had to go to an EDC seed bank. So definitely we need to find some funding for education and any way possible that the state could help provide some funding for that purpose would be great. Deschutes County is a tourism recreational county. It's not an agriculture county, and there's so many people that have moved in to the Bend area from all over the United States and the world that don't have an idea about what these noxious weeds can do and how evasive they are. So I would definitely like to see somehow the state do something about it. And another problem we have a state-mandated law that says that we're supposed to enforce a state law, and we don't get funded anything from the state. And my particular county being Deschutes County, I don't get any funding from the general fund. All my funds come from grants and contracts that we do at the county level. So I guess that's about my 3 minutes. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. I'm Tanya Beard from Marion County Weed Control District. I am the coordinator for the local district here. I'm an environmental specialist and botanist by trade and training. You have a copy of my written testimony, so I'll just sort of expound on that a little bit. With regard to the question about the SWCDs and the overlap between the weed districts potentially and the SWCDs, I can speak for our local version. Our local SWCD has a directive not to do any specific outreach, and by that I mean they don't go and contact folks when they recognize that there's a problem. They wait for individuals to contact them, and that doesn't always happen because landowners are not always knowledgeable enough to realize that they have an issue that needs to be contended with. So that's one issue there. The other issue associated with that original question is that the our local, anyway, SWCD folks do not have the ability to recommend treatment options, particularly chemical options. They simply don't have the training or the licensure to allow them that opportunity. So those are two issues that we're dealing with locally, and one thing that makes the weed control district here so important as a connection between the citizens and dealing with noxious weeds. Additionally, the weed districts are absolutely imperative to be funded stably. We need to have knowledgeable staff, which all of the folks representing here are. And we need to have the ability to utilize flexible treatment options. SB 629, thankfully, is attempting anyway to address the fiscal stability element of our problem. The challenge, as was mentioned earlier, is where exactly is that funding going to come from? If I might be so bold as to recommend taking a look at some unusual options, perhaps looking at kilowatt-hour taxes on a lot of the windmills that are going in, that might be a potential source of revenue that hasn't been discussed yet, or things that are occurring in other states across the nation, such as tire taxes. And those tire taxes are actually dedicated dollars to noxious weed programs in their states, and they have been very effective. As far as the use of this this money, what we're looking at, what we're asking for, is baseline money that can be used as grant match against things from the Oregon State Weed Board, against grants that are offered through NRCS, through the Bureau of Land Management, and other agencies across the state that are in the position to offer grant dollars at this time. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much.
My name is Vern Holm. I'm the coordinator for the Northwest Weed Management Partnership. It's an agency, non-governmental, non-regulatory, put together to serve the needs of six cooperative weed management areas in northwestern Oregon. I work with over 100 partnering agencies from Astoria down to Florence, over to the Cascades, and then to the confluence of the Deschutes and Columbia and back to Astoria. So cover about 15 counties with over 100 different member organizations. Universally, in the CWMAs, folks really, really want to see county weed boards. Currently, the CWMAs are doing a great job, but there is no particular designated funding for infrastructure for the CWMAs, nor in most cases is there any funding for dedicated weed control workers at SWCDs or watershed councils. And actually, when you get down to it, very few in state agencies other than ODA have staff directly involved in weed control. So if we had county weed boards that at least set up an infrastructure for the public to go to for answers and a hierarchy for solving problems, be very, very welcome. And I believe I can speak very well for the cooperative weed management areas by saying that they would very much embrace the thought of county weed control districts.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your input, because obviously you have a lot of experience with this. Are there any questions for this panelist? Okay, Senator Atkinson.
confirm, just for curiosity, what's it cost to be a member of your partnership?
It is free. Basically, I get, I'm the only staff person for Northwest Weed Management Partnership, and my money comes from grants and awards, and this whole thing is set up to be free of charge and voluntary, and there's no obligation for anyone to be a member. As the only staff person, I just don't have a lot of time to go out and recruit people, so the people that have joined up pretty much have sought me out and said, hey, what does it take to become a member? But
well, that's impressive. I mean, your list is huge.
Thank you. Yes, it is.
It's been a tremendous job. And quickly, what's your source of funding? What is it, state, federal?
Whatever I can get.
We're always scrounging.
Yeah. We're always scrounging. Thank you.
Nonprofits as well. Do you get grant funding from foundations?
We try.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for sharing this information. It's really helpful.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks
for coming today. And we have Lisa DeBrucker. Okay. And then Terry Witt and Jim Welsh, and I'm going to cut you guys down to 2 minutes because we hear from you all the time, and we want to make sure we have enough time for folks who travel far to get here. Thanks for coming today.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Lisa DeBrucker. I'm the Oregon Invasive Species Council Coordinator. Our council consists of federal, state, local, and tribal governments, nonprofit organizations, and industry representatives. In our mission, when we were established by the legislature in 2001, is to keep invasives out of Oregon, and for those that get into Oregon, to eradicate or control them. We do support Senate Bill 629. It aligns with the missions and goals of our councils as it is presented, primarily because early detection and rapid response are the key to controlling invasive weeds in Oregon. And this can best be achieved with funding two counties to initiate and support noxious weed programs. In closing, Madam Chair, I would like to mention that our council is about to launch a statewide management assessment of invasive species. Our council has long recognized the need for a statewide study to look at efficiencies, overlap, and gaps in legislative and management authority of all invasive species. At the conclusion of that assessment, we'll be hosting another statewide invasive species summit and be presenting the results of that assessment. And I think those results will get at some of the questions you and others have about gaps in efficiencies and overlap.
Great.
So thank you.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing that report. When do you think that'll be?
It will be available in the fall, probably around September.
All right. Thank you. And if you could make sure that our committee gets a copy, I appreciate it. Okay, gentlemen, you have 4 minutes between the two. You can duke it out. Who gets?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, here today actually representing the Marion County Weed Advisory Board. I'm on my second term there, and I've also recently been appointed to the Oregon Invasive Species Advisory Board as well. I can't really add to much of what the other folks have said. I think we all realize that it's like the Fram oil filter. You can pay me now or you can pay me later. $10 filter today is better than paying 100 times that much for a new engine later on. But we are in obviously dire economic straits to where providing funding for this needed activity is really quite slim to none, basically. What I would like to just add briefly is that working with our weed advisory board, we do allow our water and soil conservation organization to basically focus their attentions on things other than invasive weeds. And so while we work together, I think we focus solely on invasive weeds in the Marion County area and look for innovative ways to get those things done and focus pretty heavily on education. I know our organization has provided a number of small grants to do things like put together a illuminated weed board for education purposes, provide some equipment that our supervisors can work with community groups to go out and do weed pulls and provide some other information for posters and those kind of things. And it's forced us to try to find some innovative ways, and I think one that you'll be hearing about this session is Brenda Pace, has put together House Bill 2424, which expands the Adopt a Highway program to include invasive species weeds. Brenda came to our board and put forth that concept, and I worked with her to help her get it into legislative form and get it through this into the system, and that's now moving through. So I think with tough times, we're forced to do some innovative things, but education is indeed the key, and when we get some dollars, hopefully we'll be back and be able to get some work done on the ground.
Great. Thank you, Terry. And I think I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, so we appreciate the innovative approach.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, Jim Welsh here representing Morgan Cattlemen, Oregon State Grange, and I got a call from the Wallowa County Livestock Association. They wanted their name in here, too, to support this effort. We realize that we don't have the funding, but we support the bill and the direction, and we realize also that it does align very much with this statewide strategic plan for noxious weeds. So we're supportive. We'll do what we can, and our hat's off to those who want to help. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Quick chair, question, Madam Chair. The Invasive Species Council, how are they funded? How are you funded?
We're funded with $15,000 biannual general fund, and we're funded with approximately $60,000 of lottery fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming here today, and thanks everybody who traveled far to share your comments. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 629. We'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and we have somebody coming into the room in about 30 seconds, so perfect timing.